sit down with a clean slate and talk with Putin. This is what Pope Francis has requested. He's offered the Vatican as a venue. And I haven't heard anyone in Ukraine say they're willing to do that yet. The Russians said they would be willing to do that.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. It was a great discussion. Andriy Dobryansky, Chair of UN Affairs, Ukrainian World Congress from New York, thank you. And Harley Schlanger, thank you. Schiller Institute, Germany, Potsdam, Germany is where he spoke to us from. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitagvay and the team. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now, we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وَأَوْفُوا بِعَهْدِي أُوفِ بِعَهْدِكُمْ وَإِيَّايَ فَارْهَبُونِ وَآمِنُوا بِمَا أَنزَلْتُ مُصَدِّقًا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون ولا تلبسوا الحق بالباطل وتكتم الحق وأنتم تعلمون. وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واركعوا مع الراكعين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me, me alone, should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications, and me, me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UN aid chief says a recent earthquake in Syria and Turkey was the worst to hit the region in a century. Israel is the scene of protests for the sixth straight week against the right-wing cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu. And tens of thousands of teachers rally in Portugal's capital, Lisbon, demanding a pay rise. Hello and welcome your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. It is 6 days since a powerful quake hit Turkey and Syria. Over 28,000 people have been confirmed dead and the death toll is still rising. Officials and medics put the toll in Turkey at over 24,600 and in Syria at above 3,500. The UN aid chief who has visited Turkey's quake hit area says the number will double or more. He says the earthquake was the worst to hit the region in a century. Tens of thousands of rescue workers are scouring flattened neighborhoods despite freezing weather. The World Health Organization says almost 26 million people have been affected by the quake. To get more updates regarding the quake hit areas on the Syrian side, we're joined by our correspondent Mohammed Ali with the latest updates. Mohammed Ali, if you could please tell us what is happening and how well the rescue operations are functioning.
Yes, first of all, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the death toll reached 5,273 people killed as a result of this earthquake. Of course, this number includes both the Syrian government-held areas and terrorist-held areas in Idlib and its countryside. According to the UN, more than 5 million people have been affected in Syria so far as a result. Of course, most of them in those affected areas like Aleppo and Latakia have become displaced. They're homeless. There's no place to go. The Syrian government is doing its best. Over 180 temporary shelter centers have been established, mainly public places like schools and mosques have been turned into shelter centers. Now, perhaps this is the main challenge for the Syrian government, finding suitable places in this cold weather for those displaced, large number of displaced people, and also providing them with the necessary basic aid, food and medicine, as well as blankets. And we know that many countries have been trying to help Syria since this earthquake hit the country. Up till now, more than 60 airplanes coming from over 20 countries have landed in various Syrian airports, loaded with humanitarian aid, on top of which, of course, those countries are Syria's allies and friends like Russia and Iran. Humanitarian aid is being distributed as much as soon as possible by the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, and even NGOs and ordinary people have been trying to help as much as they can, exerting efforts, whether providing what they can with the food and medicine, or even trying to distribute alongside with the Syrian government and help those affected. However, more help is needed, but unfortunately, there are the sanctions on Syria by the United States and Western countries were not lifted. Nothing was probably offered from them, except for just yesterday, we heard that there were two airplanes coming from Italy that landed in Beirut, loaded with humanitarian aid for Syria. But search operations continue despite the fact that it has been 6 days, and hopes are fading for finding anyone alive still over there. But dozens of buildings have collapsed totally, creating this disastrous situation in Syria.
And Mohammed Ali, you also did mention how sanctions have been hampering the rescue operations there. But what about the regions that are not under government control?
Yes, we also know that the area in Idlib and its countryside also was affected heavily by this earthquake. Of course, this is an area controlled by the terrorists of the Al-Nusra Front, mainly over there. The Syrian government is expected to send humanitarian aid from government-held areas towards the Idlib terrorist-held area through Saraqib, crossing point between those two regions. We're still waiting to hear about that. Also, we heard that a couple of trucks were also sent from Turkey into those terrorist-held areas by the perhaps humanitarian NGOs and some UN perhaps help coming there. But this is not enough. There should be more efforts made in order to help everyone here. There is a large number of people affected. Everyone needs help, especially in Latakia and Idlib, and also in Aleppo and its countryside.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, joining us live from Damascus. Now, the presence of millions of Iranians in the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution rallies has sent a strong message to the enemies of Iran. Despite the enemy's plots to create instability and division in the country, either by backing recent riots or imposing sanctions, the Iranian nation has once again proven that they are united. They have showcased their unwavering support for the Islamic establishment in this year's rallies.
Independence, freedom, Islamic Republic. This is one of the mostly heard slogans during the rallies marking the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This slogan has been the main demand of the Iranians since the victory of the revolution that toppled the Pahlavi regime and ended the Western domination and exploitation of Iran more than 40 years ago. Now, 44 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran is an independent nation moving toward progress and development.
Despite the challenges we have been through, we can say that Iran is one of the most independent countries in the world.
However, hegemonic world powers who were kicked out of Iran have always been against a strong and independent Iran. Over the years, Iran's enemies, particularly the U.S., have tried every tactic to undermine Iran's security and stability. They have pursued a regime change policy by clapping inhumane sanctions and supporting riots.
People have taken to the streets today to show that the Iranian nation is always a supporter of the establishment, the Islamic Revolution, and the leader. Today's rally proved that the enemy's efforts to create insecurity in the country have been futile.
We have participated in today's rally to show our support for the Islamic Republic. We might have some problems in our country. However, this doesn't mean we are going to stop supporting Iran and the establishment. We will stand strong and defeat the enemies of our country.
Massive participation of Iranians in Bahman 22nd annual rallies is a powerful reminder of how people stood against foreign powers and their pawns who sought to destroy the country's sovereignty and independence and make it subservient to the West.
For those who want to see and for those who want to hear, look at this crowd. This is the Iranian nation. They're here today for their land, for their country, for their government. We will have disputes, we will fight within the family, but this is all one family. We will have problems, but we will solve it. Look at this people. This is the Iranian nation. These are the Iranian people. They're here today, 22nd of Bahman, 1401.
In spite of all these problems that we're experiencing these days, we still are showing that we're united.
The presence of Iranians in rallies marking the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution this year has been more significant than the previous years, particularly after a period of foreign-backed riots and increasing Western political pressure on Iran.
The mass rallies marking the Islamic Revolution anniversary are held each year with tremendous patriotic fervor across Iran. These rallies are also a show of solidarity and send a strong message to the enemies of the Islamic Republic. Over the past 44 years, the Iranian nation has remained resilient and united in the face of enemy sinister plots. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
We asked activist and political commentator Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi how different Iran's Islamic Revolution has been compared to other revolutions around the world.
After passage of 4 or 5 months, nowadays, every other day, one of those fake news are being revealed that they were trying to drag the people to the streets by false and fake news. Yet, and behind all those propagandas by the Western countries, and still yet it's going on. So this time again, you may look to the streets of different cities across Iran, and I'm sure that eyes of millions and hundreds of millions of people across the globe is towards Iran today. And I'm sure that they will not be disappointed as people will come into the streets. Iran, Iranian revolution, as you mentioned, has inspired people across the globe. This inspiration that Iran has given to the people of the world has two main important dimensions. First of all, I do believe that it all started with changing, shifting, presenting a new perspective, new point of view to the and it brought a new understanding and new meanings for the term revolution itself, for the term Islam, for the term of social justice. It gave people a new sense, a new understanding.
For the sixth week in a row, tens of thousands of demonstrators have hit the streets of Tel Aviv. They are protesting against the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet. The protesters called Netanyahu a dictator. They said his, quote, fascist cabinet's proposed judicial reforms plan to threaten checks on ministers by the courts. They say the reforms would also tighten political control over judicial appointments and limit the Supreme Court's powers to overturn cabinet decisions or Knesset laws. The coalition also intends to intensify the expansionist policy with more settlement units in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu returned to power last November, and his cabinet is believed to be one of the most right-wing in the regime's history. Author and radio host Stephen Landman says Israel has always been an extremist regime and has committed all kinds of crimes against Palestinians.
Well, indeed. I mean, Israel has been an extremist regime from day one before it began in May 1948. And now it's worst of all, the most ruthless regime of all under Netanyahu. I believe 32 ministers, I think 6 women among them, just a rogues gallery of gangsters. That's what the Israeli government is comprised of. And of course, it has full support from the U.S., from other Western countries. Israel does whatever it wants, slaughters Palestinians, commits all kinds of crimes, wages wars, terror bombs Syria, and the U.S. eggs it on, encourages it to continue.
One of the biggest protests in Portugal in recent years, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets in Lisbon amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis.
I think the government will have no choice but to listen to us, and if we are persistent and if we do not abandon the fight, I'm convinced that the government will really have to listen to us.
We are here to claim our rights, which were taken away from us a long time ago. Our careers have been frozen for a long time, and that can't be. We have the right to have a more dignified career. We can't work like this. It just can't be.
It's the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise, and they are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. This, as the Portuguese education minister has said that negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing, and expressed hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of the Western Europe's poorest countries, which is seeing a decades high inflation and is grappling with a cost of living crisis. In the French capital, Paris police has clashed with people protesting the government's pension reform bill. Hundreds of thousands of people attended the rally, which was also held in a number of other cities across France, seeking to keep up pressure on the government over the reform plan. This is the first weekend protests over the pension reform bill, which plans to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. President Emmanuel Macron says the reform is vital to ensuring the viability of the pension system. In a statement ahead of the marches, all of the main French unions called on the government to withdraw the bill. They warned that they would seek to bring France to a standstill from early March if their demands were not met. This follows the first week of debate on the pension legislation in Parliament. The opposition has suggested many amendments to the bill. Russia confirms staging a massive attack on Ukraine's critical energy facilities. The Russian Defense Ministry has spoken of major air missile strikes on the power infrastructure of Ukraine's military-industrial complex on Friday. The ministry did not elaborate on the facilities hit. As a result of the strike, the transport of foreign weapons and ammunition by rail to the battlegrounds in Ukraine has been blocked. Ukrainian officials say Russia has hit power facilities in six regions with missiles and drones, causing blackouts across the country. Ukraine has been bracing for a new Russian offensive ahead of the war anniversary on February 24th. Moscow denies targeting civilians and says the facilities it attacks support Kiev's war machine. Canada says it is working to retrieve the wreckage of an intruding unidentified flying object that was shot down by a U.S. fighter jet.
Recovery operations are now underway and will be supported by the Canadian Armed Forces in conjunction with the RCMP. This coordinated operation will allow a further investigation into this object. We have no further details about the object at this time, other than it appears to be a small cylindrical object and smaller than the one that was downed off the coast of North Carolina.
Hannon added that the object was flying at 40,000 feet. She also said the object was taken down on the orders of the Canadian Prime Minister. Earlier, Justin Trudeau said he had spoken with his U.S. counterpart on the issue. On Friday, the U.S. said it had shot down another unidentified flying object in Alaska. The Pentagon offered few details about the object, including its size and traveling altitude. The new developments come after Washington shot down what it called a Chinese spy balloon. Beijing said it was a meteorological apparatus that had accidentally entered U.S. territory. It also slammed the U.S. move to shoot it down as an overreaction. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
France has been hit by nationwide strikes as protesters voice their opposition to the proposed pension reforms. It is expected that the strikes will continue to impact daily life in France in the coming days. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more.
Throughout Rodin Disregard, for the third time in less than a month, hundreds of thousands of workers across France participated in strikes and rallies to protest President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular plan to force people to work longer before they qualify for a full pension. The latest nationwide mobilization against Macron's assault on French retirement benefits brought at least 750,000 people to the streets, with turnout lower than on January 19th and January 31st. The recent walkouts and marches came one day after the National Assembly began debating legislation that would raise France's official retirement age from 62 to 64 by 2030. Rachel Keck, the first cleaner in France to become a lawmaker, said during a tense debate in Parliament recently, "Those of you who support this reform don't understand how tough jobs are, what it's like to wake up with aching back. You don't understand what it's like to take medication to get through the workday. You don't understand because it's not a world you live in." The leftists continued, garnering applause from fellow opposition lawmakers. During a recent rally in the city of Nice, pensioner Bernard Chevalier echoed Keck, saying that "we are worn out by work." He said retirement should be a second life, not a waiting room for death. Opposition to pushing back France's retirement age is widespread, with recent polling showing that approximately three-fourths of the population is against such a move. Nevertheless, many of Macron's allies remain determined to fulfill his campaign pledge to overhaul the nation's pension system. Last week, Macron characterized his effort to hike the retirement age as essential, while Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren claimed that doing so is no longer negotiable. Recently, Labour Minister Olivier Dussopt dismissed opposition lawmakers' accusations that the government is in denial over the scale of protest and doubled down on the supposed need for change. Dussopt told RMC Radio, "The pension system is loss-making, and if we care about the system, we must save it." But as Agence France-Presse reported, some of the government's own experts have said the pension system is in relatively good shape and would likely eventually return to a balanced budget, even without reforms. Reuters reported union leaders and left-wing lawmakers, meanwhile, say the money can be found elsewhere, notably from the wealthy. Organized labor, for its part, intends to launch repeated waves of mass demonstrations until Macron and others, who insist on the need to cut retirement benefits, are defeated. Philippe Martinez, General Secretary of the General Confederation of Labor, CGT, said recently at a march in Paris, "This reform will upend the lives of several generations. If the government stubbornly forges ahead, we will step up our protest with longer and harder actions." Striking workers in strategic sectors, including electricity production, transportation, and education, disrupted multiple aspects of daily life recently, though to a lesser degree than they did twice last month. Macron's bill faces an uphill battle in the National Assembly. Notably, the New Ecological and Social People's Union, NUPES, a coalition of four left-wing parties recently formed by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, won 131 seats in last June's parliamentary elections, denying Macron's neoliberal alliance ensemble the absolute majority it needed to ram through his unwanted austerity agenda. However, journalist Marlon Ettinger, citing French Communist Party lawmaker André Kasigan warned recently that the government might try to pass the reform through a social security financing bill known as PLFRSS, which would allow for a series of constitutional delays that would significantly limit the amount of time deputies can discuss the bill. It would also block the possibility for the opposition to present their own counterproposals. In addition, although Macron has no popular assent nor a parliamentary majority for his reform, he does have constitutional tools he can use to push the package through, Oettinger explained in Jacobin, adding one known as 49.3, after the article of the Constitution which grants the president this power, essentially lets him bypass the National Assembly. The Constitution of the current Fifth Republic grants the president these authoritarian powers to hedge against any popular sentiment that might make its way into the lower house. The use of 49.3 would suspend the debate in the National Assembly, then send the bill directly to the Senate, which is controlled by less Republicans. Laurent Berger, General Secretary of the French Democratic Confederation of Labour, CFDT, told a Parisian crowd recently that concessions offered by the government, such as allowing people who start working early to retire early, are just patches. Berger said increasing the legal retirement to 64 is the core of this reform and it is deeply unfair. It's a democratic folly for the government to turn a deaf ear to the protest. Another day of action is planned in the near future. Also, Reuters reported a national strike against planned pension reforms reduced France's power supply and disrupted petrol deliveries from French refineries recently. Strikes have been taking place since mid-January as unions protest against the government's plans to make people work longer before retirement. Public transport and schools have also been affected. Total power supply was reduced by about 6.3% or 4.3 gigawatts due to decreased supply at two nuclear reactors and several thermal and hydro plants, data from power utility EDF showed. Nuclear capacity was lowered by 1.8 gigawatts and thermal plants were reduced by 2.3 gigawatts, while hydropower disruption totaled 220 megawatts. No imports were needed at 2011 after peaking earlier at 2.8 gigawatts, grid operator RTE data showed. Strike participation at EDF totaled some 30.3% of employees by midday, the utility said. This compares to the midday rate of 40.3% recorded on January 31st. On the refining side, the shipping of petrol products from French sites was interrupted by the strike, Total Energy said. The company added that there was no shortage of petrol at fueling stations and supply levels were generally satisfactory. About 56% of the operators working in the Total Energy's French refineries and depots were on a strike, the company said. At Esso, a subsidiary of ExxonMobil, about 75% of the workforce at the FAS site was on a strike and blocking deliveries while the Port Jérôme site was operating, a CGT spokesperson said.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens and break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, we'll analyse what might be behind the suspicious murder of an Iranian Sunni imam who was found dead after initially being kidnapped earlier this month in southeastern of the Islamic Republic. So who was Molavi Abdul Vahid Righi and why was he killed? This next report will shed some light on this upsetting episode.
An Iranian Sunni cleric was kidnapped and murdered by unknown assailants in early December amid ongoing Western-backed anti-Iran violence across the country. Molavi Abdul Vahid Righi was the Friday prayers leader of Imam Hussein Mosque in Khash, a southeastern county in Sistan and Balochistan province. Local forces had been mobilized to find the whereabouts of the cleric, but his dead body was found not long after his disappearance on a roadside with three bullet wounds to the head. Prior to his death, Molavi Righi expressed strong support for the Islamic Republic of Iran and admitted his views earned him death threats. Iranian authorities have issued warnings against enemy plots aimed at destabilizing Sistan and Balochistan, a region home to many Sunni Muslims. Sectarianism is a tried-and-tested tactic used by the West to destroy Muslim countries who fail to submit to Western political hegemony. Iran may be facing the same challenge. Meanwhile, the violence has claimed the lives of dozens of people and members of security forces, while also allowing terrorist attacks across the country.
Well, joining us in the studio today are two esteemed guests. The first is Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, a UK-based Muslim scholar and lecturer who studied inside Iran for many years, and Masood Shajaray, the head of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on the show today. Masood, I'm going to come straight to you on this because you may have met the martyred Maulana a few times in the past. Could you just start off by telling me what your impression was of the man?
Yes, he was well known as a scholar and someone who supports the concept of unity and the Islamic Republic Foundation and the leadership. He was receiving a lot of death threats and the pressures from external sources and so forth, but he really was one of those exceptional scholars, Sunni scholars, who was not only believing in it, but was extremely vocal in his support. And in reality, I think we need to understand that this is the position of overwhelming majority of Sunnis within Iran. I was in Qish last year, and when I went around and I saw the sort of reflection of the unity, you know, there were Shia mosque, Sunni mosque, Adhan, few sort of minutes in different timing. But, you know, people, and when you talk to people, everybody wasn't seeing what the problem is. And Qish is one of those areas where it's almost 50-50. And people were articulating to me that they intermarried. They really didn't see problem there. The problem seems to be more something is a creation of an image that is created outside by sort of individual sort of agents and those who actually want to create disunity. And we know that divide and rule is one of the things colonials have done and used as effectively over years and years.
Do you think that that's what we're seeing happening now in the south, east of the country? You think that perhaps there's some kind of attempt to divide Sunnis and Shias?
Oh, this has been going on since the beginning of the revolution. I mean, if you look at how many anti-Shia books were before the revolution, you hardly could see it. You know, there was probably one or two. When you look at the Ikhwan al-Muslimin sort of leadership, there was always Shia and Sunni sort of representation, even at that level. But what we are seeing now after the revolution, there were books after books after books being published in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, pumping this sort of idea of these are others, they're not one of us. And I remember in UK, I was running of a mosque. And as everybody knows, I've come from a Shia background. But the mosque was actually a Sunni mosque. And I was the vice president of it in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And we were going around trying to find Qurans from different places. And when we went and approached, Central Mosque and other places in London to get some Qurans, we couldn't find Qurans, but they were actually willing to give us tons and tons of books which are sectarian promotion. So really that was happening just very clearly, and you could see it so clearly, and that has continued since then till now, and has become more sophisticated.
For sure. Sheikh Hanif, let me bring you in on this discussion, because again, you've been to Iran. You know perhaps what it's really like there behind the negative headlines which we've seen circulating around. Last episode, we discussed the fact that there are anti-Iran protests going on right now, but it seems like this assassination of a minority religious leader is something different here. What's your impression of what's going on in Iran right now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I don't think it's different. I think, first of all, you know, it's a natural human tendency to love each other. That's the most powerful tendency, right? You know, people of different ethnic groups, racial groups, religious groups, and so on, living together normally, all right, they will build bridges with each other. The differences or hostility between these groups always come from the outside and always come from people who find, or communities or countries or whatever, or political interests and so forth, that find it important for you to have a division in order to control for their benefit. Okay? As Brother Mahsoud, correctly stated, before the Islamic Revolution, you know, you would hardly find anti-Shia books in the Sunni community. Okay? After the Islamic Revolution, which is calling for the Muslims to overthrow Western imperialist domination, okay, you find a plethora of anti-Shia books in the community, and even anti-Sunni type of things also appearing in the Sunni community by those people who are partners in that project. Okay, so that project is not, it will exploit both sides. Now, when we are talking about the Mahsa Amini thing, all right, it is quite interesting that, first of all, yes, you had this anti-Shia stuff going on and a lot of infiltration into Iran and so on. But you also find it coincides with the Russia-Ukraine war, you know, and the fact that Iran is supporting Russia, you see, in this. And if you see the increased intensity, right? For example, in places like Pakistan, making almost extortionate demands on countries in Africa and Asia and so forth to force people to take a side on this, you see this Mahsa Amini thing started to ramp up. Okay. So I think the assassination of Shahid Rig and you know, the Mahsa Amini thing, and the Russia-Ukraine aspect. All of these things are coming together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And with respect to Iran, they're using classical, I don't know if you'd call it soft power or regime change by stoking what are not really divisions, but could potentially be divisions in a society. For example,
they're
divisions
looking for wiggle room, somewhere to exploit.
Yeah, you know, divisions in belief. Male, female type of things, you know, youth, older generation things, right? Mm. All of these things are natural sort of like, not really divisions, but, you know, categories in society, if one could call it that, you see?
And potential areas to exploit that. Use the economy to their benefit, that type
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly.
Yes, you know? For sure.
So I think, people who are, you know, cognizant of the trends of history, would be able to pick that up.
Now, Masoud, before we move on to the next segment, you've got about a minute left or so. I want to ask you, we don't actually know. I think there's been some arrests made, but they're still investigating who conducted this assassination. Could you perhaps give your opinion on who potentially could be behind it? What are the anti-Iran groups that are active at the moment?
Well, really, to pinpoint who did it at the name and the sort of so forth, it is difficult. That's security forces thing. But it's obvious that those who are threatening him, those who actually want to create this conflict, those who want to create this otherization, that separation, as the brother said, those are the ones behind it. What they seem to be concentrating on is to turn Iran to another Libya, to another Syria. And for that, any division, any conflict, is actually is picked up and amplified. And this amplification is also seen more outside, like Syria and Libya, seen more outside than inside. But also, I think what is important for people inside to recognize is that the lives of everyone in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan was shattered through this intervention and conflict creation. Of the West, and which has served no one except the weapon manufacturers and the State of Israel to have a conflict in the whole region.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your opinion so far. We are going to come back to the discussion. But first, let's take a moment to browse through some online opinions and reactions to the shocking and disturbing news of the scholar's assassination. We have a tweet coming here which says, all praise be to Allah and to Muhammad and his blessed family. May God preserve the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is from Abu Muhammad 16, who adds that His Eminence, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, and all of those who are working vigilantly to protect the Islamic Republic, Godspeed to them. We have another tweet coming in from Ashraf as well, who gives a very strong opinion. He makes a very bad point, saying that may his soul be rest in peace. It's tragic how the enemies of Islam and peace despise Muslim unity. Remember, Martin Luther King was supposedly ready to unite with Malcolm X. All of a sudden, there was an assassination attempt, a very valid point, I think, which can be used to compare perhaps what's happening here in Iran. Let's move on to Rahul now, who comes in with another strong opinion, who adds that he makes very, very clear that they should arrest all of these terrorists, do whatever they have to in order to resolve the situation. These terrorists want to turn Iran into another Libya or Syria. And finally, let's move over to an opinion coming in from JJ, again on Twitter, who says, killed by those looking to turn Shia and Sunni against one another for political gain. Just think who would gain from that. Sectarianism is a tried and tested tactic used by Western powers to divide and rule the Muslim world. That's absolutely clear. This next report touches on how and why these tactics have been successful in the past and used to weaken the Ummah so much.
Western colonialists have long sought to drive a wedge between Sunnis and Shias across the Muslim world as a means to divide and weaken the Muslims. And this is also the case in Iran, which has a large minority of Sunni Muslims living within its borders. Sunni Islam and Shia Islam are the two great Islamic orthodoxies which comprise the vast majority of the Muslim Ummah. Sunnis believe that the Prophet's companion, Abu Bakr, Umar and Uthman were his rightful successors, where Shias believe that the Prophet's son-in-law and cousin Ali should have been his heir. At first, the differences between the two Islamic strands were simply political, but they later developed some theological differences too. That said, the commonalities between the two main strands of Islam are far greater than their differences, and Sunnis and Shias have largely coexisted in harmony throughout Islamic history. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has repeatedly emphasized the need for Islamic unity so that the Ummah can successfully revive. He has also repeatedly said that Shias must not harm the sanctities of the Sunnis. But despite this, the imperialists and Takfiris are trying to falsely claim Iran is anti-Sunni, with the ultimate goal of weakening the Islamic Republic.
Well, let's head back to our guest discussion now, and I'm going to bring in Sheikh Hanif once again. Tell me, you was in Iran for many, many years. You know what it's really like there. There seems to be this misconception pushed sometimes that Iran is like this Shia-majority country which is intolerant to its Sunni minority. And I've heard things like there are no Sunni mosques in Tehran, for example. Could you just clarify if that's the case or not?
I have traveled quite extensively in the south of Iran, where a lot of the Sunni population is concentrated. I've also been to Kurdistan, which is quite majority Sunni. And I see on the community level, there's no hostility, there's intermarriage. You know, Sunnis have their own masajid. You know, Shias could come in there and pray. They have their own madrasas, okay, that are independent, you know. And you don't see on the social level any kind of tension, you know. I wouldn't doubt that you would have probably elements that might be sectarian. I think this is something that occurs in religious communities by and large. You know, there might be people who might have these types of tendencies, but you don't. They when I was there, they were not dominant as an idea in the community. So I really don't see a problem. You know, the same was like in Iraq, for example. In Iraq, you know, you had Sunnis and Shias getting married and so on. As soon as the Americans want to take over the oil and so forth, then you find a propagation of anti-Sunni, anti-Shia stuff going on in Iraq. You know, people who were married, you know, families were broken up and so on. And I think, you know, basically when you find these types of phenomena, you have to ask the question, who has the most to benefit from this? You know, I would always, always go back to basically Western and American interests.
And Masood, I want to ask you again, you know Iran very, very well. Do you think that Iran is perhaps vulnerable to the same type of sectarianism push from the West as, say, other countries in the region have been, like Iraq, for example?
When I went to Qish last year, even I was surprised the level of the unity on the grassroots. I mean, you know, talking to the taxi driver, talking to people around the city, you know, I was so conscious to find out what is really going on that level, because, you know, any other level could be manipulated. And people genuinely were saying, we don't have a problem. There are efforts to create these problems, but we are united. We are so sort of almost together, you know, bonded together. But there are elements, you know. I mean, look, in Iraq, what happened, I remember two British soldiers dressed up in Arab clothes were arrested, armed to the teeth with bombs, and they were arrested. What do you think they were doing? You know, if you go to one community and dressed up as that community and bomb the other side, and then next day go to the other community and bomb the opposite side, even if there are people two sides of same street and have no other difference other than that, they start fighting each other because they see people from that side of the street that are attacking this side and from this side to that side. So it's easy to create that. And I've been involved. We have a program called Charter 3103, which is from the verses of Quran, At-tasmu bihamdillahi jami'an. We go for conflict resolution. We have done these settings in Pakistan, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, and it's been extremely successful, bringing people from the Salafi background, from Sufi background, from Shia background. And when you put people together over a few days, praying together, eating together, joking together, and so forth, you see the bonding. And, you know, people going through that process usually come back and they say, look, before we used to go to studio of TV studios and we used to really go for each other. Now, we're ashamed of doing that. Mm. We actually cannot go for each other that way because on the level of heart being brought together. And I think the verse is actually deals with that. It's not a political unity. Allah says, unite. And you remember the times that you were separate from one another, then I brought your hearts together. Mm-hmm. So we need to unite on the level of heart, on the level of, you know, brotherhood and so forth. And I think the other really important thing is that the creative illusion, and I've seen it. I was giving a talk once, and a brother from a Salafi background got up. He said, what you're saying about unity is fantastic, but it's impossible. Mm. I told him that, well, look, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala orders us to unite. Do you think Allah is joking with us? They're asking us to do something which is impossible? Mm. The impossibility is being put in our brain. It's not the reality.
Wow.
It is possible, and we need to work on it, and we need to get rid of these illusions that the enemy is creating to divide us.
That's a very strong story to end your point on. I'm going to come back to you, Sheikh, on this and ask you about this concept of Islamic unity. I think right now we do live in an age where there does seem to be a divide between Muslim communities on many issues. Sectarianism, to a degree, perhaps has been partly successful. But do you think that this concept of Islamic unity is possible? And if so, how can we get there?
I don't think it's possible. I think it's natural. It's not just possible, it's natural. I mean, when you look at the history of Islam, okay, you never found a situation. You very rarely would you find a situation where people are forced to convert to Islam, you know, in contradiction to Western propaganda. Okay, in fact, what you would find that in the Christian countries, okay, you had more intolerance, okay, than in Muslim countries for other religions, not to mention other Muslim sects or points of view, okay? So when you look at, for example, classical Spain and Al-Andalus, which was an Islamic country, a 100% Islamic country that was close to 800 years, for 800 years. When you look at the golden age in Iraq, you know, you find a confluence of different thought, Christian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, you know, Pahlavi philosophy and the sciences and so forth. Everybody was free. You found that some of the greatest advances in traditional Jewish thought was under Maimonides, you know, who was living in Islamic Spain and had that freedom to do this.
Yes, that's okay? Right.
Okay? Yeah. All right? So when you could have that type of unity with other religions and cultures, you know, what about between Islam, you know, between Muslims, you see? When you look at the Christian world, however, you know, you have things like the 100-year war, you know, between Christians. You know, you had Christians slaughtering each other.
The Dark Ages, I think, were during the Islamic
Golden
Age, wasn't it?
You know, when they retook Andalus, You know, you had blood flowing in the streets from Jews and Christians. When the Jews were fleeing this persecution, where did they go? Did they go north to Germany? No, man, they went south to Morocco because they knew Muslims would be tolerant towards them. This whole new idea of Muslim intolerance and so forth is actually fomented by these puppets of the West. Saudi Arabia, for example. You know, elements within these countries and so forth. So I think we have to be able to be cognizant of history to be able to understand these things.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. Unfortunately, we are out of time. There's so much more we could have discussed, but we'll have to leave it there for the time being. And thank you to everyone at home for joining us for this edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Assalamu Alaikum.
In the limelight.
A new poll has found that nearly two-thirds of Americans believe that the U.S. is heading the wrong way. Also, according to this poll, U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating remains low. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Hill wrote in this regard, there is no shortage of pressing challenges facing the U.S., the debt limit, inflation, the southern border, and surging violent crime rates are just a few. Yet, recent polling by Schoen Copperman Research reveals a precipitous drop in Americans' confidence.